I'm Coulter DeVries, owner of Ranch Investor Advisory and Brokerage Services. I'm an accredited land consultant with the Realtor Land Institute and proud member of ASFMRA.
The Ranch Investor Podcast is the most downloaded and informative industry-specific content that intrigues while entertains.
Studios of Holly Fretwell's Kitchen. Coulter DeVries is going on the road.
Woohoo! With three huskies. two huskies in the lab.
Always a dog in the background. Especially when you go to a ranch. There's usually a greeting party of three blue heelers and border collies. And so today we're going to be talking about whips and carrots, incentives and regulation. You have a study that's close to your heart, something you've been analyzing that you want to bring up, and I'd like to hear more about that. I've had a chance to look at it a little bit, and I'd like to hear what your thoughts are on it. First, let's get started, Holly. Who are you? What do you do? Why am I here in your kitchen having coffee with you?
That's a great question, and that actually goes back a long ways, Coulter.
It does.
My name's Holly Fretwell. I actually recently resigned from a position at the Property and Environment Research Center, where I was the outreach vice president. And there I've been working with PERC for, 25 years. I'm still doing some contract work with them because I love some of the issues that they work with. I was just ready to move on and start doing some other things and working with my boys. But prior to that, I taught up at MSU for many years, and Coulter was one of my students many years ago in economics. And we reconnected, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, just to have a conversation about what he's doing and what I was doing at the time.
Because I was such a shining student, Holly. Property Environment Resource Center, PERC.org, also known as Free Market Environmentalism. So what projects are you looking at today?
What I'm looking at today, and I've been doing for about the past year, is actually looking at some regenerative agriculture and holistic grazing. And I guess that's another reason that really brought us together, because that is, ranching is not my specialty. I grew up in the city. I moved to Montana some 40 years ago, but for the outdoor activities. And I was looking out in Paradise Valley, which is such a beautiful place, and realizing how developed it was becoming and how a lot of the society, just not only in Paradise Valley, but in many of our wide open spaces here in Montana and across the West, are really being filled in with subdivisions. And sometimes it's sort of this exurbia where somebody will have one big house or maybe a little ranchette. Sometimes it's these little subdivisions that are going in. And I was curious, coming from a free market perspective, that is, I don't want to see government regulate stuff. I want to see how we as individuals can actually use markets and competition to try to enhance environmental quality and conservation. And I was trying to think about what are some of the ways that we might see that occurring in a place like Paradise Valley. And so I started on this mission to research what are the opportunities for ranchers and large landowners to generate revenues in addition to what they're already doing. Again, I don't know a lot about ranching, but certainly you have your cattle that you can raise money from, and sheep and other livestock. You can have some crops that you are growing to raise some money. But what are the other opportunities? And I think one of the growing things that we see in the West is recreation and outdoor activity, which again is why I came here. And so I started to ask some of the ranchers that I was that I knew, and other ranch managers that I knew, as to what they thought about that and putting accommodations and Airbnbs and that kind of stuff. And a handful of them said to me, well, why would I do that when I can actually really dive into my agriculture and my soils and enhance my soils and increase my profits that way? Then everything else is really just sort of that extra benefit. And that fascinated me. And so I sort of took this deep dive into holistic grazing. And I'm still fascinated by it, trying to figure out where it works, when it works, and how much of our landscapes really are being subdivided and developed. And is there anything happening on the opposite end of that, where we have large, wealthy landowners that are purchasing more and more landscapes and sort of concentrating the ownership instead?
You know, I had talked about this via email once, trying to protect or enhance Western landscapes at scale, especially in, we'll call them, critically sensitive or critically important habitat areas like the migration corridor north of Gardner, Montana, north of Yellowstone National Park, in the Paradise Valley where your heart and passion is located. That it's tough to think that increasing agriculture and livestock revenues even 100% would change land ownership, because most people are buying that for exclusivity. And it seems to me that the real value is in recreation. So hunting, birding, horseback riding, watching bison migrate, elk migrate, and doing that in a way where you have it all to yourself. This is all mine, locked gates, no one else has access to this. This is a benefit and a right that I, amenity that I get to enjoy exclusively. It seems like there's more value in the exclusivity. How would increasing agricultural yields, financial yields, even 100% make a difference? I struggle to see that. I think it's got to come from other benefits, amenities being monetized that people don't want to monetize. You don't want to give up. You don't want to have John Q. Public on your place.
Right. No, I think it's all of the above. And I'm still interested in looking at sort of that, all the opportunities for additional revenue sources. I fell into holistic grazing because that's one thing that it seems to me, if you can actually increase your soil function and increase the amount of productivity that you have, so you're increasing your profits, and that's one way to increase that revenue stream, that adds so many added benefits from it. And those added benefits include, you know, we have more wildlife that are able to live on the landscape. We've increased the habitat. We have better birding. So now suddenly you have all these other opportunities that are available for these ranchers to monetize at the same time. But if you start here with that really focus on your soil function, it's just got all these multiple benefits that go along with it. And I think there are concerns from many individuals as well. Well, are we going to exclusivize this stuff so there's absolutely no access? And I guess it depends. What's your end goal? What do you want? And my end goal isn't to provide public access for everybody on every landscape. I would like to see enhanced conservation on these landscapes so that we maintain large landscapes. And I think one of the ways to maintain those large landscapes and not have that development on it is to have working landscapes that are profitable. And I think they have to be more profitable than they are. We're going to lose them because the opportunity cost is just way too high. The value of development on these lands is way too high. There's too many people that want to be a part of that. And I would much rather see it stay whole and not have any access to it at all, but know that we have these migration pathways that still exist there, and that we have these birds that are repopulating out there, and that the wildlife have a place to be, and that there's actually somebody out there that really cares for the lands, and it's not the government. It's individuals that actually own those landscapes and that care for them and that are doing something with them to make them productive, not only for wildlife, but also for people and for the food that we eat and the clothing that we wear.
So it seems like increasing agricultural yields via holistic and regenerative practices is not the end goal. You don't want, necessarily, your target isn't to just create more revenues based on good ag practices. It's those good ag practices have positive externalities, and rotational grazing, rest rotations, changing season of use, hopefully that's going to improve the hydrological cycle, the soil health. That's going to reduce the amount of cheatgrass in that area and noxious weeds, invasive species. All that has a positive externality that the public is benefiting from. The tragedy of the commons, someone's doing it, someone's getting the benefit of it, but someone else is paying for it, the rancher, in a sense. So do you think that maybe the ag is just a tool, agriculture is just a tool that could be utilized to, if you want to keep landscapes intact, we need to monetize positive externalities?
Some of those externalities or some of those additional benefits that we're getting are non-market goods, right? You have wildlife habitat, and how do you monetize wildlife habitat? Well, if you have hunting and fishing on your landscape, you might be able to monetize it. Maybe you can monetize it through birding, but maybe you are creating habitat for monarch butterflies or something else that somebody's not going to pay you to come on the property. How do you actually monetize that, and that becomes, sometimes that can be a little bit more difficult. We can think about water, if we enhance water and the water retention, so we enhance water on the in our streams, and so we actually have additional water. We do have water markets exist out there. They're extremely complicated, but we're starting to figure out how that might work. Carbon in the soil. We have a lot of talk about, you know, selling carbon credits and having carbon markets for soil sequestration. I don't think we're quite there yet with the tools to be able to do that. Maybe someday we will get there. But all these pieces, as I was looking at how we would monetize these, sort of came together when I started looking at the holistic grazing and said, well, all these things are benefits of that. So if you could actually increase your profits through holistic grazing, then maybe additionally you can tap into some of these other externalities that exist out there. Maybe you have some enhanced wildlife that somebody's willing to pay for. Maybe there are, you know, conservation organizations that are willing to pay for, you know, seeing wildlife on your land. So we have camera traps on some landscapes that, you know, we have conservation organizations that say, you know, we'll actually pay you X dollars if we see a grizzly bear, or if we see a so many elk on your landscape, or if we see wolves, or whatever it is that conservation group wants. The reason I sort of tie back into this holistic grazing so much, and I'm still learning about it, maybe I've fallen head over heels into something that isn't quite the rainbow that I think it is, but the reason I'm fascinated by it is because it's sustainable. If you actually have ecological function in your soil that you can continue to grow more and more on that soil and you continue that productivity, and it continues over time, then we have, and it continues to generate revenues over time, we have this economically viable product that exists out there that's helping us maintain these large landscapes. Not to say we're not going to monetize for these other things, but that's just a really cool starting point. If you say instead, well, we have these conservation organizations that are going to pay you for seeing grizzly bears on your land, I don't see that as long-term sustainable. Where's that money coming from for that conservation organization to pay you that? And it seems to me that it's sort of a subsidy in senses, and I don't see the long-term viability of that continuing in the same way that I see if we can actually increase the productivity of our landscapes in different ways. So I think there's many different tools here, and we have to think about sort of a stacking all the different options that exist out there. But in my mind, it starts on the ground with that ecological function and making sure we have good conservation conservation isn't even the right word. We have good ecological function on the ground, so we have this productive landscape, so these people that own these lands, that are caring for the lands, are actually able to increase their profits directly without having to seek money from some conservation organization or government agency, but they can actually do it in the marketplace. So it seems to me that it's much more economically viable, long-term sustainable, and potentially scalable, but maybe not everywhere, because again, we're not going to get that type of productivity just from changing how we treat the land in every location.
We have quite the audience. They're asking to be part of it. They want to pitch in their 5 cents and get their words in. They want to go chase some deer, these big huskies.
Unfortunately, that is exactly what they want to do. It's not a good thing.
And maybe get some porcupine quills in their nose, too. So you've mentioned landscape scale, large ranches. As a private property rights, free market person, what's wrong with subdivisions in the West? If one of my private property rights is the right to dispose of. I can sell it when I want, how I want, subdivide it. If I have 2,000 acres, I can dispose of it 100 different times at 20 acres per disposition. What's wrong with the Paradise Valley becoming 20-acre home sites?
If your property right, in my mind, you do absolutely have that right. The reason I don't like that outcome, and I'm not going to regulate it, but the reason I don't like that outcome is because I think there's conservation values there and habitat values there that are super important for the greater Yellowstone ecosystem to ensure that we have these wildlife on that landscape. And again, my goal is to say, well, how do we motivate these landowners to maintain these large landscapes instead of developing them without telling them they can't, without just regulating them, but instead helping them realize the revenue potential from other opportunities. And how do we get there? And I don't know if we can get there in time. I mean, we're already seeing it being developed, but I do think that there are opportunities there. And we can flip this on its head a little bit. There was a study that was put out just last year by a handful of folks, several of them from Montana, from Montana State University, that said, you know, the development and the subdivision is not our biggest concern. Actually, our concern is concentration of these landscapes. Now, I think these authors went a little bit too far, and they talk about this trend of concentration across the West of you know, landowners, big wealthy individuals grabbing more and more land and increasing the size of these landscapes. And they are very concerned about this in the sense that they actually say these large land holdings consolidate near monopoly positions in local land markets. I think that's, you know, way over the top as to what's actually happening. I don't think we have enough information or enough time to see that we're actually seeing this concentration taking over the West. But it's a different concern. It's sort of the opposite side of it. And in my mind, it would be much easier to see enhanced conservation on these landscapes if they were single owners. But there are other issues that then arise from that, and that is the access issues and sort of this equality or inequity that people are very concerned about. But I think there's lots of different ways we can think about trying to enhance conservation, and it's going to be different everywhere. And one of the keys in my mind is to say, well, what is it that the private landowner wants to do? And if they want to subdivide it, how do we maybe motivate them to not subdivide it or to get a different individual in there that says, you know what, I actually do want to see this landscape large, and I'm willing to put some money out there. And there are a number of landowners that have done that.
So take me back here. I'm now lost and confused. There is a research study from homegrown here, grassroots-ish academia, MSU, saying that consolidation and its assemblage value in the West, in particular Montana, is bad. That generally, I don't know, bad given what goal or what the outcome they're looking for, but consolidation of large billionaire ranches and conservation groups were identified in that. Nonprofit.
Yep.
You don't have just billionaires, but you have churches and conservation groups. That this is antagonistic towards what? Why? What are the negatives that they found? And this is peer-reviewed?
This actually is in the Society of Natural Resources journal, I suppose. It doesn't actually say journal on it. But it is a note that was published. And so I assume it was peer-reviewed. I don't actually honestly know that. But they did. They looked at 12 different counties across the greater Yellowstone ecosystem in the plains in Montana. And they tried to figure out how much acreage was being concentrated under single owners. And they did come up with some trends. And maybe I'm not looking at the data in depth enough, because they decided there were some trends that we were seeing this increased concentration, and there's certainly a few counties that did have some increased concentration. They talk about it as though it's this overall trend across the West, and maybe I'm just misreading it, because that doesn't seem like we have sufficient data to demonstrate that for sure. And even the data that they have, I'm not sure it really demonstrates this overall trend, but there definitely is some occurrences of this concentration happening. And, you know, we know this is occurring in Paradise Valley. We have some landowners that have purchased several large tracts of land. We know it's occurring in eastern Montana and in various other places. And their concern is, again, I mean, it just sort of fascinated me, first of all, that they sort of overstate this, but then secondly, that this is their concern, this is going to happen across the West. And one of them is, they say the concentration of ownership also accompanies a concentration of power. And so their big concern is that when you have more and fewer landowners that are wealthier, they suddenly have this ownership over this landscape, and they can restrict access to other people, and they can do whatever they want with it. And some of these new landowners are enhancing conservation. We're seeing some of that in Paradise Valley. And some of them are developing more intensive agriculture. And so maybe that's not enhancing the conservation value of it. And a lot of them are not allowing access on the land, or maybe allowing only that exclusive access on the land, right? So I guess whether you say this is good or bad depends upon what the outcome is that you're looking for. Again, what I'm looking for in Paradise Valley and in these really high amenity valued places across the West, especially when we're thinking about wildlife habitat and the value of those migration pathways, is enhancing the long-term sustainability of protecting that wildlife habitat in one way or another. And so actually having a single owner is much easier to negotiate with than 50 little owners. And presumably, and this is an assumption, I guess it depends how they develop the landscape, your wildlife are going to have much better access if you only have one owner on that land instead if you have, say, 50 homes on that land. Right.
This study must have been post Yellowstone. This could be called like the Dutton Ranch study. if you assemble a huge landscape, a huge ranch, you have power. And I've never seen the show, but I understand that's what it's about, is mm-hmm. the power of this one ranching family.
Right.
So are we trying to bring the Dutton Ranch into academia these days?
Perhaps, because this study was actually 2022. Yellowstone is not my favorite TV show. I have watched it a couple of times, and that was plenty for me. But it comes up often in the conversations that I have with people, because there are some crazy examples that are brought up in that show that do touch home in a very over-the-top sort of way. And this paper maybe addresses that in sort of a similar fashion.
So they're taking a cultural phenomenon, Taylor Sheridan's Hollywood script, probably the most popular TV series, Western, that I can remember, and they're trying to see, does this have real-world implications? Is this a legitimate thing? Is this actually happening out there?
Mm-hmm.
What do you see? Because I don't see that. When we see consolidation and ranches growing, maybe for assemblage value, they're not picking up 20s and 40s. They're picking up 3,000 acres at a time. They're not going to waste their time on a 20, on... The large landowner is not going to spin their wheels putting together 1,000 40-acre parcels. That would just be too much. They'd pay too much of a premium, because there's a premium on small-acre parcels. So it seems like they're just taking a landscape and they're making it more intact. That's
the way I see it. Again, I think this research paper is super interesting in the way they are trying to address this, and it's one of the first papers that has actually looked at how would you actually tabulate the concentration of landscapes or concentration of different parcels. And I don't think they're suggesting that somebody's picking up a 20 or a 40 out there. I think they're suggesting that people are picking up, you know, somebody that already has several thousand acres is picking up a few more thousand, you know, maybe even in the tens and twenties of thousands. And that is their concern. And I think it's a legitimate project, right? I think it's an important thing to understand, because we do, at least in myself, I mean, I haven't really studied, you know, real estate across the West and whether how much is being developed and not developed, but when you actually do a little bit of research, it comes out pretty quickly and pretty clearly that we're seeing a lot of development and subdivision and ranchettes that are occurring across the nation, not just across the West, and that we are, as a result of that, seeing less farmland and less ranch land that exists today and that will likely exist in the future. And that seems to be the trend that you constantly hear about. So this paper sort of takes that and says, you know, that maybe that's not true. I think they take it too far, but I think it's a super valuable piece to say, maybe that's not true, and here's why. Here's some of the other things that we're seeing happening. I think I disagree with the paper in the sense of, I think, you know, keeping more lands intact across the West, especially in these areas that we have really critical habitat, I think it's a better thing. But that's just a disagreement in the sense of what is the outcome we're looking for, right? And so, again, that's one of the reasons that I'd rather see this stuff happen on the private landscape than on the public landscape. I've studied public lands. I know what happens on our public lands, and they're not always managed very well. We have wildfires across the West for good reason, and it's not because we've taken really good care of our forests. It's the opposite. And when you go on our national parks, there's some serious issues in the national parks, right? We have some serious deferred maintenance issues that they haven't taken care of year after year after year after year after year. And private landowners tend to do a better job. You know, they have that ownership. They get the direct return from taking good care of their landscapes. And there's a different motivation. There's a different driver, and they don't have to respond to political budgets and politicians telling them what to and not to do. So this idea that we have a concentration of land, to me, in private hands, I'm okay with that, and I think it's easier to deal with for conservation outcomes.
Well, we're changing what we want out of society, because originally we wanted a family on every 160 acres. But no, we wanted people to prove up that you put fence, you till up the sagebrush, you fence your property, you dig a ditch, so you do go access the creek, the water rights, you drill a well or dig a well back in the day. And we wanted people to develop every 160 acres, Homestead Acts 1 and 2, and we did a very good job of that. I think someone will have to fact check me out there, but I think we brought some 3 to 4 million immigrants from Europe to mainly Montana, the Dakotas, Nebraska, Colorado, and Wyoming. And we settled the West. We had a population out here producing ag products, producing a stable food program for the growing United States. And now we're finding out that, okay, 160 acre family plots, well, that's not gonna support a family. It might be a nice little recreation property. But the smaller you go, it seems like the more problems that creates with mismanagement, overgrazing, horse ghettos, not fully taking care of your soils, weed encroachment, definitely no place for bird habitat. Your migratory birds are not going to be nesting on a 20 acre subdivision or less, 20 acres or less. They're gonna fly over that, bypass that, or die out. Their numbers will shrink because there's no place to procreate. But it seems like what you're saying is our paradigms are shifting. We have settled the West. We optimized a lot, many of the things we could. We proved that we are a stable food producer for our own people. Now it's time to think about how do we, so we stabilized food and we stabilized citizenship and residency in the West. Now how do we stabilize habitat, wildlife?
That's a key question, right? I think that's a key question. And then how do you do it from using private motivators rather than public dollars? And the reason I'm opposed to public dollars is because, for one thing, I don't think it's sustainable. You don't know if you're going to get those same dollars year after year after year. And then you have politicians that get to decide where that money goes. And sometimes it's going to good purposes, and sometimes it's not. But it's very politically directed, and I've seen problems with that. So again, I'm trying hard to figure out how do you do this from the ground up and from the private sector rather than from the public sector. And I think there are tools. And again, I think sort of this regenerative agriculture, holistic grazing is one of those tools. But I think there are many tools that we need to look at. And some of those tools might be conservation organizations saying, you know what, we're willing to pay for some wildlife habitat. And there's some really cool things that conservation organizations have done in that sense. And that's just one more tool. Again, I don't think that's a sustainable and really scalable tool, but it's definitely one that we can make use of. And we have sort of the, what do we call them, the Airbnb for birds, if you will, in California, right, where the Nature Conservancy is actually paying farmers to keep their lands wet, their rice farmers to keep their lands wet, so that when the shorebirds come through, there's actually a wetland there for those shorebird migration pathways. And that's a really cool program, right? That's a super cool program. So I'm not opposed to those types of programs. I just want to come up with more opportunities for ranchers, and I want to come up with more opportunities that are actually in the private sector, so people are really motivated to take care of what they're doing, right? So if we have more accommodations and services on some landscapes, you know, maybe ranchers want to do some of that, and maybe they don't, but maybe there's another private individual that says, you know what, if I put a little tiny house over here on your land, you know, let's negotiate a deal, I'll manage it, and then you get some additional revenues from it. And we're going to do it in a way that it's tucked sort of out of the wildlife habitat, but people can actually watch those wildlife. And we don't want 20 of them. We want it to be exclusive, because once there are 20 of them, the wildlife are no longer going to come through there, right? So you have to be really careful as to what, you know, what you're pushing and what you're not pushing. And I think that the private individual does a better job of realizing, if I put too many homes there and the wildlife are gone, then people are not going to come see the wildlife. And I think that's super important. I think that internal understanding and motivation is really important to drive some of this.
Do you think Nick DeCastro's platform, landtrust.com, is a tool that can help with what you're looking to accomplish? Is that kind of on the front end of monetizing some of these benefits that good land management provides the public?
I think LandTrust.com is doing a fabulous job helping landowners
Free
monetize.
Plug for Nick, by the way. he did create an awesome product. It's a necessary service that I see ranchers. So that, I'm going to take a quick tangent and then allow you to answer after I cut you off, Holly. But here's a tangent. We talk about ranchers. To me, the future landowner is not a rancher. A rancher is someone who derives their primary source of income from Schedule F, from the sale of livestock or ag crops. And historically, going back to the homesteader era, most landowners were not subsistent, but they had their life and their business based on agricultural production. I see that changing. I think that's fading out. Obviously, you can't pay for a $10 million ranch with cattle and sheep, and even if you ran ostrich and whatever, bison, you're not going to pay that thing off in 100 years. So I think the term rancher, as our understanding of someone who manages and controls Western resources, or just even Oklahoma, natural resources. I think that's kind of behind us. Hunters have come to Montana with far more money, conservation groups, churches again. So one, I think ranchers, that term is kind of fading out. And so it's like, who is this new landowner? What do we call them? What are their goals? What are their values? And they don't need to make a living off the cattle. But now getting back to LandTrust.com, you believe that is a way to bring in more revenue that's going to go strategically to the right areas at a lower cost, better than USDA can do it, and BLM and Forest Service?
For sure. And again, what LandTrust.com has done is sort of let's go back to the beginning when I was chatting. What am I interested in? I'm interested in coming up with different revenue opportunities for ranchers, and as an academic sort of research project, right? I'm just interested in how this works, and then how do you help get that on the ground? What LandTrust.com has done is get that on the ground, right? They've lowered the transaction costs for large landowners to provide opportunities for the public, and they've done it in a way that really, they're like a broker, right? They're pulling these two different groups together. And think about what else you can do that like that. I mean, it sort of started with Airbnb and Vrbo and that kind of stuff where, you know, we're just going online to platforms where we can actually go stay in different places. Okay, now we can go hunting and fishing doing that. Well, what about if we could, you know, do some of these other revenue opportunities that we're trying to look at and say, what if we had different types of carbon sequestration in the soil that we were able to sort of pull into that equation? What if we had other, what are some of the other revenue opportunities that might exist out there? What if LandTrust.com actually incorporated some Airbnb in there so it was one platform for outfitting, fishing and hunting, accommodation and stays, birding, which I think they're trying to look at a little bit. You know, what are all the different things that the public wants access for? And what they've done is make it easy for the rancher to provide that access and generate revenues doing so. And I think that's exactly what we need to do to ensure that we're enhancing the conservation. Now, I think one of the arguments that somebody may come up with at some point in time is that, well, if we do that, then suddenly we're going to develop this whole thing we're going to get all these Airbnbs out there, we're going to get way too much. But again, as long as the landowner understands why people are coming, they're going to cater to that, and that may or may not be what you or I want, right? But that's what's going to be catered to, and I think the LandTrust.com has done a great job getting that started.
So Holly, if Nick DeCastro and LandTrust.com democratized access, they kind of democratized the utilization and access to benefits, features, and amenities of ranches. What are your thoughts on democratizing the ownership? If Coulter DeVries and Ranch Investor came out with a crowdfunding marketplace where 100 investors could buy fractional ownership, co-investment, whatever you want to call it. You can decentralize, not decentralize, but eventually decentralize it to where they can all manage it themselves, but that's years down the road with lower transaction costs because of technology. But today we're not there, so today it's more like a syndication, a traditional syndication. What effect do you think that would have if more people who wanted to have exclusivity? In my belief, you buy a ranch for the exclusivity, exclusive rights to digging dinosaur bones, mining gravel, developing wind projects, hunting elk, just watching porcupines chew on a tree, whatever it is. Is that going to benefit, enhance ecology? Because ideally, my theory is you'd be bringing in people who have a lower required rate of return. It's not the rancher who has to put food on the table, put his kids through college, his or her kids. It's people who are valuing the conservation and the recreation higher, and their opportunity cost of capital is lower.
Right, right. I think it's a great opportunity to, again, sort of expand who has access and lowering the transaction cost to get more people out there on the ground and valuing the different things, the different externalities, if you will, that we've talked about, that all of us as individuals value, right? Because what I value, again, is very different than what this paper valued, right? What I value is seeing that conservation and that enhancement out there. And I'm less concerned about making sure that everybody has access to it, because I think those two don't always go hand in hand. And so enabling more people to invest in a piece of property and have just a portion of that property provides more opportunity for more people, in a sense. I think that was very circular, but I do think there are some great benefits in that, because if you don't allow, at this point in time, most of us don't have that opportunity, and so we would never imagine, like I would never imagine actually owning a ranch or a piece of a ranch. I don't have that type of a wealth. But I could imagine having a timeshare where I could go to a different, I can go to Hawaii 1 week out of the year, right? And that has opened up, timeshares have opened up the opportunity for people to actually have a condominium somewhere where they never could imagine having that, right? And now they might have that opportunity in a smaller piece. And so I see this as something slightly similar in the sense of, you know, suddenly it's affordable for me to be a part of something that I never thought I could actually be a part of. And that's pretty cool.
The thing with timeshares is you own rights. You actually have a right to a contractual time. What I'm thinking is you don't have the right to time. You have an interest in an investment entity that, one, its job is to produce a positive return. Its job is to be a good investment. For 100 people are going to have 100 different reasons for why they invest, and so you're not going to keep everyone happy to the same level. And I don't agree with egalitarianism. So those who invest more should have better opportunities, not rights, but better opportunities. And I had sent you my thesis, per se, draft on how do you fairly divvy up recreational days, not timeshares, but recreational days, use, benefits, and features. How do you divvy that up and also incentivize a higher level investment so those who have more at stake have more benefit? And what I kind of came up with, Holly, which I appreciate your feedback on, was this program, much like graduated bidding, much like a right of first offer. So an option to where if you have four tranches, four levels of investment, let's say $100,000 minimum, tranche one, tranche two is 200, tranche three is 300, tranche four is 400, just for easy math. Those, the incentive to come in at 400 versus 100 should be prorated, maybe not prorated, but it should be reflective of what benefit you're going to obtain. So if I came in at 400, I would like the assurance that I'm going to have a better shot at having the ranch for my exclusive use, either the week of July 4th for my family, or the week of October 31st for elk hunting. And do you think that that model will incentivize this monetization of positive externalities?
I think it's a fascinating model, and I think how you, as we've discussed, how you sort of determine how you're going to bid on who gets what opportunities can be complicated. But the idea that you have one group of people or one individual that's paying more than others, you certainly need to provide them with some additional benefits, or there's no incentive for them to pay more upfront to get that. And I think there's lots of different ways that you've thought about trying to approach that and figure out how to allocate those different times for individuals to hunt out there. As far as monetizing the conservation benefits, a lot of that is still going to be dependent upon who's managing the ranch and how, or the landscape. Maybe it's not even a ranch, managing the landscape. And you need to incentivize that as well, right? You need to make sure that manager is motivated to enhance wildlife habitat so that there is good hunting if that is what people are bidding on, or so that you have maintained lovely places to stay if people want to come for 4th of July, so that's actually being maintained. And again, one of the big things with economics is making sure that people understand the incentives, because incentives matter. And one of the reasons that I am so pro private property rights is because when you own something, you take better care of it, because you very directly get the benefits from good stewardship, and you also very directly pay the cost of poor stewardship. And that's very different in the public sector, right? We have middlemen and other people in there that don't actually realize it. If politicians can rally for something in our public lands and they want to have a big new interpretive center or some big fancy,
money well spent.
Museum that exists out there, but that they don't actually have to pay for it, right? So there's no incentive to make it low cost, and they don't have to look at the opportunity cost. Like, if that money wasn't spent there, where else would it be spent, right? We might actually prefer to see, the sewer system in Yellowstone being fixed instead, but that doesn't really get a whole lot of public support until it actually breaks and people understand that it's a problem. So again, long story to say, incentives really matter. So your idea of how you're managing this landscape, everything sort of has to tie together to make sure that people are motivated to respond to each other, and there's some good feedback that exists there. So if your manager's not taking good care of the land, that those individuals that actually have invested in this have some recourse to make sure that land is taken care of in the way that that they intended it to be when they invested in it.
So that brings up something where I would think the alignment of interest between the limited partner, the investor, management, the general partner, and for holistic sake, because I like to think about, do you positively affect the local community, the wildlife habitat, the ecology? So ecology, economy, and profits. How do you holistically keep everything in mind? This could go really sideways if it was just a 5-year hold period. I mean, you could take in 100 investors at $1 million each, you raised $100 million, you went and bought these incredible landscapes, you developed the hell out of them with lodges and lock gates and timbered as much as you could, and then you sold it. This seems like it would need to be a long hold period to show that what management, landscape, resource management we are implementing is in the best interest of the investor, the limited partner, because we're adding value over time. It's very slow in an 11-inch pre-sip zone. Your grandkids will appreciate it, but it's going to be hard for you to come out and see the changes every year. Seems like it has to be a long-term plan, and maybe that's where the government falls short.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true, because again, like you're saying, if you have a just a couple of years that you're investing, then great, woohoo, you go get what you want in those few years. You don't really care about what the future is. But again, that is why the private land ownership is so important in my mind, because you have it for long term. And you may not, maybe you don't actually have it for long term. Maybe I invest in something and I think I'm only going to have it for 5 years. But the return, the value that I get in 5 years is going to depend on how I steward that. If somebody wants to go out and develop it, I don't think you're going to get the same investors, right, as if you're going to get if somebody wants to go for hunting. Who am I to say that it's better to have it developed or not, or better to have it left as conservation? I think, you know, there's some science out there that says there are some really critical habitat areas that we do want to conserve. And those are the areas that I'm saying, whoa, we really need to do something here to think about how to motivate private landowners to ensure that we're keeping these landscapes whole. But when we're looking at the edge of Bozeman, maybe my backyard with a six-story building that's going up, who am I to say that it's better to not have that because I liked my little backyard the way it was, right? Somebody else's property, they had the right to do that. It's frustrating, but nonetheless, you know, what is the highest valued use? And the market oftentimes directs us to those highest valued uses, but we do want to make sure we're internalizing those externalities. And I think that's the hard part that we're trying to get at with these conservation values. Sometimes it's just hard to internalize them, but we're getting better, and technology is helping us. And LandTrust.com, you know, with the internet, with that ability and that new technology, is helping us lower those transaction costs to help monetize some of those benefits that we as the public really like that previously were really hard to put in the marketplace.
Yeah, so thinking about where we are today, your house on the north side of Bozeman, cute, quaint, old neighborhood being gentrified rapidly, you were obtaining a lot of benefit by it being cute, quaint, quiet, these narrow streets that are now jam-packed with parking, hard to find parking, nowhere to pile up snow. Now, because there's an influx of people living here, but you were gaining benefit that you didn't have to pay for. Were you not?
Yep. And we can come down to sort of the Coase theorem. There's this reciprocality there. Did I have the right to that nice quiet? Was that my right when I moved in? And therefore, this building should have compensated me, this builder should have compensated me when they built? Or was that just a, you know, externality that I was enjoying, and the actual owner next door owned the right to make all this noise and whatnot? You know, again, we don't
noise and congestion.
Noise and congestion.
That's now a cost to you.
Yeah, for sure. Who owns that right? And the interesting thing with property rights is, you know, if they're not really well defined so that we know exactly what it is that we have the right to or not to, then it's hard to say that cost is being put on me, or I put a cost on them if I tell them they can't do it. You know, interestingly, we have, you know, city commissions and county commissions and politicians that decide how things are going to go, and they very easily change zoning rules and other things that you thought you bought into. So you thought, when I bought, I thought I knew that I had certain rights and that it was going to be residential next door, and that zoning was changed by the commission so that it is now commercial, and it is instead of a several story condominium buildings, you know, like I have down the way, actually duplexes, which is what was, you know, sort of intended to go there when I bought, it's changed to a seven-story building. So I thought I had rights that I don't, because politicians can change those rights, right?
And that's what we're seeing with a new legislature in Montana is, can we return more rights or better benefits to landowners, such as guaranteed elk tax? That's an important one. Currently, when you buy a ranch, the probability of you having a landowner tag is pretty low, and you drawing the general pool is even lower. But would it be an incentive? And Colorado does a very good job of this. Ranching for wildlife, better grazing practices, rest rotations, seasons of use, working with hunters so that the ranchers benefit by obtaining a $15,000 tag for a trophy bull elk based on allowing public access, better grazing management. And I think you're right. When it comes to who's bearing the cost and who's receiving the benefit, it can change at the whim of a new house, new Senate. And
yeah,
that's scary for any landowner. But I would hope that advocates like you and PERC.org can keep promoting Milton Friedman. And hopefully we've learned our lesson about Keynesian economics. And
right, I'm not sure we're really there, but we're hoping that we can move in the right direction. And I think again, the tags, incentives matter, right? If you provide those incentives for landowners to take good care of the land, they're more likely to do it. And by providing, you know, elk tags for them to be able to sell to others or use in their own right, is motivating them to do a better job protecting that habitat and providing that habitat. So again, aligning those incentives is super important and sometimes harder than others. And, you know, again, politics gets to choose oftentimes how that works, and politics has different drivers. They have different incentives than individual citizens.
Well, if you were feeding me Paul Krugman articles and slamming Keynesian economics down my throat when I was in college, I wouldn't be here doing a podcast episode with you. So thank you. Thanks for advocating for free markets. Appreciate that.
Well, I'm glad you not only learned something during that class, but you ran with it. Now you're teaching me a lot of stuff on how to make sure we can get this stuff actually working in the world.
Free markets are important to one's own identity of sovereignty.
For sure.
Of self-reliance. I mean, how are you supposed to value yourself in the world and your place in the world if you feel like your decision is not your own?
Mm-hmm. Agreed. And, I sometimes get in trouble for this in conversations, but I think it really all does come back down to property rights and really having well-defined and secure property rights. And one of those very first rights is the right to self, right? You have the right to make your own self-determination, to decide for yourself, as long as you're not harming other individuals, right? That's where we need to draw some lines, because if I hurt you, then I also need to be liable for that harm that I've done to you. And when we think about having those clear rights, markets really function well when we have really clear rights, and they don't function as well when we don't. And so we need to make sure that we have an understanding of what we do own and what we don't own, and that just makes trades so much, the cost of trade easier and lower.
Well, thank you, Holly. Please keep us all updated on your work of the Paradise Valley. I'd love to check in again and have you on again when we talk about democratizing ranch access and making it so that not just billionaires, conservation groups, and churches can own vast landscapes in the West. I think that is going to be important going forward. People who have a lower opportunity cost, who have different values, not fiscal, financial, economic values, but social values. And I'm going to stay away from the ESG term. That's a scary term for me right now, but we all have values, and I think bringing people in to land management with those values of conservation and long-term sustainability, regenerative ag in your case, that will create positive externalities. It's exciting. I think technology is going to help.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for inviting me. It's been a fun conversation.
Holly Fretwell, stay in touch. Thank you. Oh, one more thing, listeners. Give us your comments. Please comment on this, what you liked, what you did not like. Give us your feedback, what you think is shit, won't work out, what needs to change. We want to hear it all. Be candid. Even be a troll. We don't mind. So let's hear it all. Thank you.
Click subscribe on your streaming platform so you know when the latest episode has dropped. Be the source of knowledge and the maven that other professionals are excited to refer.